Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's December 23rd, 2018, and welcome to episode 184 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and New Year's retro resolutions. I'm joined here by a couple of my esteemed colleagues and co-hosts, one we haven't heard from in a while, and we're really happy to have him on the show. Hello, Ken Gagne.
Hello, Earl. Thank you for commuting my sentence and letting me come back on the show.
Well, I need to let you know the vote wasn't unanimous. But
it never is.
I was in your corner, man.
Well, you know, especially in this divided era we live in, I don't expect anything to be unanimous.
Exactly. But the RCR is not shut down. I just want to point that out.
We are ready for work.
Yes, we are.
Making as much as we always do.
Right. Nobody's given us a pay cut or a furlough. And also from the same geographic region, as luck would have it, Paul Hagstrom. How are you doing, Paul?
I'm doing well. I work in academia, and the semester has ended, so we're into the holiday break time, so that's good.
Are you able to take a break during that time, or do you have preparation work that you've got to be doing?
Well, yeah. The work changes, but briefly. But yes, that's true. I have to prepare things for next semester, but maybe I'll take just this day or two.
Gotcha.
If you don't mind.
Don't mind at all. Happy you're here. And my daughter's home from university, actually, and she is mostly not taking the time for preparation. She's kind of ODing on Netflix and just flopping around the house. I guess it was a really rough semester with some of the courses in her major. So anyhow, we're here, and we want to talk about retro, and as we're coming up on the new year, it's just on the horizon, we want to talk about the plans we have for retro and 2019. It's perhaps, as Paul pointed out in the show notes, the same question as, what didn't you get to in 2018? So it's kind of cheating, but that's all right. You know, there's lots going on in the retro world now. There's new products. There's new archives. There might be plans about things that are newly available or maybe scheduled to come out in 2019. And we also have to ask the question, when we talk about New Year's, can we get through this time without making the what is your New Year's resolution joke? And I don't think we can. Paul? Ken, minus 640 by 480, ba-dum-bum. Yeah, that's what I thought.
All right. Well, no, I think for me it's like, what, 280 by 192? I think that's what it is.
So we should go around the table and talk about our plans. And Paul, since you suggested this topic, why don't you start out?
Oh, I have, yeah. Well, so I definitely have the, you know, all of the 2018 plans left to do in 2019. Actually, you could probably go listen to whatever episode this was a year ago. But yeah, I just my major plan is to organize and find everything in my office space, just so that I know. Ken, by the way, I have a box with your name on it that I have to give back to you after like 3 years or something that I've had this thing.
I don't want your dirty laundry.
No.
I'm not going to wash it for you. You got to grow up and do your own.
In fact, I know where it is. I have a box that says Ken on it. It has some microzines and a couple of a la software things. And anyway, but yeah, so that's one thing, organize and find. And the other thing that I would am interested in is the, so we've talked a number of times about this applesauce imager, disk imager for the Apple II, and there's just a second revision out that is, it's designed to be better capable of handling 3.5-inch floppies as well. And so my main sort of target goal for 2019 is to just run through all of the stuff that I've got, image now the 3.5-inch disks, because those I think are even flakier than the 5.25-inch disks. And also I'm going to try to find some place to organize them online. I've been kind of tinkering around with this Yesterbits site that I have for, it seems like, a year and a half, trying to figure out like how can I organize things so I can link together software companies and, you know, platforms and authors and that kind of stuff. And I just need to get some frictionless way to put things in so that I can just get going on the imaging. So that's my plan.
Cool.
Oh, what kind of website are you going to be using for that?
Well, right now I have, it's probably going to be WordPress at the moment. I've been, so I can dig into the mildly technical for a second. There's a thing I've been playing with for, it really has been probably 2 or 3 years, called Pods, which is it's kind of like a database backend. I don't know if you know it.
It's a way to make content custom post types, right?
Exactly, yeah. And so I was hoping I could sort of work out a nice way to interlink, like, you know, this object is a floppy, this object is for the Apple II, this object, you know, requires 128K from this company, and sort of link them together so that I can have images and, you know, hopefully kind of like a nice little museum kind of site. But I keep getting about 80% of the way through doing that and then having to do something else.
Yeah, I haven't used Pods myself, and in fact, custom post types are still sort of magical to me, but I realize that that is probably the correct way to go, and I am really looking forward to seeing the other 20% get done.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping if I do actually make something that I am pleased with, I can sort of release the skeleton so that other people could use it if they wanted to.
That would be awesome.
Very cool. So, Ken, for 2019... what are your retro plans? I imagine one of them includes another year of your fabulous Juice GS journal.
Oh, flattery will get you everywhere, Earl. yeah, Juice GS, of which I'm the editor, is committed to publishing through 2019. And to be honest, it actually... I mean, I know that when you look at Juice GS, you're like, oh, 3 columns of black and white text, just copy and paste it in. I've had people say that, and it's a little bit more involved than that, to the point where I unfortunately don't have a lot of time to do too many other projects. So my resolution for next year is there are some articles I would love to write for JuiceGS that have been on the back burner for also years. In fact, I was just putting together an email to send to subscribers about the coming year, and I was using last year's as a template, and last year it said, hope you're looking forward to next year when we're planning on publishing this article, and a Patreon roundup is the last piece. And those first two articles we did publish. The third one is the only one of those three that I was going to write, the Patreon roundtable, and I didn't write it. I think it would be fascinating to talk to Apple II users who are using Patreon as their crowdfunding platform to create a sustained regular income for their retrocomputing projects and ask them how that platform has enabled them to pursue their passion or allow them to level up their projects, and how they've navigated the various fees and rewards and goals that come with crowdfunding. So that is something I would like to finally actually do, just like I said a year ago that I would. And the other article I have is about the various ways to record video off an Apple II computer, because I record Let's Plays videos for my YouTube channel, and I've done some of those directly off an Apple II. And I actually started this article like 2 years ago, and then this past June, I dusted off that article, and I finally finished it. And then John Brooks announced the Vid HD. And I'm like, as soon as this article comes out, it'll be outdated. Damn it.
Oh, no. Yep.
So I'm like, okay, I'm moving this from the front burner to the back burner, which is the opposite direction I like to go, because I want to wait to make sure that it's including the latest hardware. So we're probably going to have a Vid HD review in an upcoming issue of Juice GS, and then I can use that as a launching point for my article about how to record Let's Plays videos for YouTube using an Apple II as opposed to emulation. So those are my two goals the next year, is to write those articles. And now that I've spelled them out, all our competition is going to go write and publish those articles before we can. Thanks.
Yep. All those other Apple II magazines.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. All the other Apple II print journals. Wait a minute.
Yeah, I don't feel too threatened.
So both of those sound awesome. And I have actually wondered myself how Patreon works for some of the people whose content I consume on a regular basis. There are some YouTube channels that I really love that use Patreon as the funding method. And in some cases, they've been able to, as you say, level up to either part-time or full-time actual employment. Like, this is their job now, making this retro content, which I think is absolutely fabulous. And it would be fascinating to find out how they built themselves to that point and to what extent they believe it's sustainable over the long term, that kind of thing. And in terms of recording video from a real retro computer, yes, that is an interesting challenge. I don't know if you guys remember a couple, 3 years ago when Carrington and I had our infamous Commodore 64 versus Apple II chess challenge that we live streamed, and we both wanted to do it with a real system and trying to figure out how to get my real system plugged into the computer and streaming and recording with enough fidelity where it was worth it was a really interesting bit of art. And we both figured a way to do it, but like you say, Ken, there are more modern options that are coming out now, so
right.
That is really cool.
Yeah, this past spring, I was fiddling around with my Apple II, and I very briefly had it streaming to Twitch. You know, and I would love to do that regularly. As for Patreon, around the same time this past spring, I moderated a panel at the convention PAX East here in Boston, which Paul has been to. Paul helped me set up an Apple II there a couple years ago. And the panel I moderated was all about using Patreon to create sustainable income or even become your full-time job. One of my panelists was Lon Seidman, who is an Apple II user who is an alumnus of the Open Apple podcast. And the audio from that panel is online. Maybe we can include a shink in the low notes, yes. A link in the show notes in case anybody wants to listen to that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would like to listen to that. Great.
And what about you, Earl? What plans have you got?
I think two. One is a little bit vague. One is rather specific. Yeah, and one is kind of a combination of vague and specific, so I'm all over the map. So here it is. In 2019, I would like to reduce the footprint of my retro computing collection. And I've heard a lot of other people in the retro world speak about similar goals that, you know, when things were cheap and people were giving them away, stuff that's in their basement and that, it was easy to suddenly find yourself sitting on a mountain of retro computing. And I'm typically not very high on the hoarder, you know, the hunter-gatherer scale of materialistic things. But on retro computing, man, it's scattered all over the place. So I want to knock down the amount that I have. But sometimes breaking up is hard to do. So I figured, here's an idea. Why don't I take a particular retro computer that's not going to be core to my collection, set it up, and use it for some indeterminate period of time, do some little projects on it, enjoy it for a little while, maybe, depending on what it is, somewhere in between a week and a month, and have my last little fling with that particular retro computing gear. And at that point, then I'll give it up. I'll either eBay it or Craigslist it or give it away or in some other way disposition that and then move on to the next thing. And over the course of, say, 2019, I will hopefully have reduced the amount of stuff that I have and been able to kind of focus my collection more on the things that I'm more interested in. Because it's not just the computers, it's the peripherals, it's the software, it's the books, It's, you know, we've talked about this, all this a million times. So that's one of my goals for 2019. And I think now I have a strategy even on how to accomplish it. And also by taking it out and playing with it, it will also let me know that it's working, or at least let me know that it's not working, because one of my pet peeves is postings or auctions for items where the seller says, not tested, condition unknown, because to me that always means it's broken. That's how I read that. So with this, I'll at least be able to say, hey, here's, you know, a widget type ABC, and by the way, it don't work. And if you want it for free, come get it, or thereabouts. So that's one of my plans. My other plan is to take the 6502 core that I got running on the FPGA for the last retro challenge and actually be able to figure out how to get some input and output out of it, so it could be the basis of a little FPGA kind of hardware programmed microcomputer that I could do some useful things with, maybe even run a version of BASIC on and make some LEDs blink and that kind of thing. So that's my 2019. And of course, you know, definitely wanting to stay involved with the podcasts, RCR and Chicken Lips Radio, where we've managed to, at the end of 2018 here, we got a little bit of steam built up again. We've released 3 episodes in a row, which is kind of astounding. We're on hiatus, but we seem to have regained our stride. So that's 2019 for me.
Cool. So when's the next without 4?
Oh, that's going to be a while.
Okay. It was good while it lasted.
Thanks for that. Yeah, all 2 episodes. I would actually really love to do more with that. And in fact, you know, as things go, there have been enhancements and evolutions of other language tools in that for retro computers. But by the way, for those who might not know, Next Without 4 was a podcast that I started out on to talk about languages and programming for retro computers. And it's still a topic that's near and dear to my heart, and I would love to resurrect it someday. Maybe what I need for that one is a co-host, because honestly, for Chicken Lips Radio, the thing that brought that out of the cellar and got that going again was a co-host. And as you guys know, co-hosts are great for podcasting. It keeps you honest and makes it more fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does sort of keep things moving. And I was, of course, just thinking of myself that it's been, I don't know what, like maybe almost a year and a bit since the last Drop 3 Inches, so.
Oh, anyway. Yeah. Well, and I really enjoy that podcast too, by the way. But I imagine that with the narrow topic, that it might be that news in that arena comes kind of few and far between.
Oh, yeah, well, I definitely have this feeling, actually it's not even so much news, I sort of have, with that one, I have this feeling like I want to do a project, you know, like I have all this software and stuff to explore, or image, or, you know, and I want to do something, or hardware to try, you know, so maybe tweet from the Apple III or something, and then I can report on it, but until I have time to do the thing, then
sure.
There's nothing to talk about.
Right. Gotcha. Time. Man, that's time.
Oh, and the, what is it called? Discovery is about to start again, right?
Oh, yes, that's right. Star Trek Discovery. That is coming up on, let's see, the 4th and final Short Treks debuts on Thursday, January 3rd. And then Season 2 begins on Thursday, January 17th. Woo!
Yeah, cool.
Excellent.
And the reason I'm so excited about that is, as you some listeners may or may not know or recall, in the time since I last appeared on this show in September of 2017, I launched a new podcast with my friend Sabriel. We are co-hosting a weekly Star Trek Discovery podcast, so we will be reviewing each episode. It's a lot of fun, very exciting.
And that means it is time once again for me to renew my subscription with CBS All Access.
Yes, or you can just listen to Transporter Lock and we'll just give you the summaries for free.
Cool.
It's not quite
exactly
as dramatic.
The same.
Yeah, it's missing a little something, like everything.
Oh, nice. Well, great. It sounds like we've got a great 2019 ahead. And coming into the new year, we probably also have some listener feedback. Paul, can I turn it over to you for that?
Sure. Yeah, I'll go through some of the things that we got here. So, first one is Sarah on the Facebook page linked to a video of Strong Bad drawing a diskette, which I find it kind of funny that it's even, you know, that there even are still these videos. This is not even a Flash video. This is someone with an actual, like, boxing glove drawing a diskette. Do you guys know Strong Bad?
I do. I'm actually watching it right now. Oh, yeah. Gosh.
It's, yeah, anyway. These were very funny Flash videos from the, you know, intermediate past. But anyway, so if you want, and there are more things on this channel of Skills of an Artist. This particular one is Skills of an Artist number 17. So that gives you some idea of how many more there are, but it just sort of goes through drawing a 5 1/4 inch floppy disk.
Yeah, and this video is, I thought this video was new, but it's actually from February. I don't know how this hasn't popped up on our channels already.
Well, that seems kind of new compared to what I think of as when Strong Bad was a thing.
Well, admittedly, yes. Yeah.
Eric on Facebook asked about something I think Carrington made some reference to carrying a supercomputer around in your pocket, referring to essentially his smartphone, I think. And Eric was asking if this was a general reference or something specific, and he linked to something called the Pocket Supercomputer that Accenture was demoing at some point. And this is not something I'd ever heard of, but it was, when was this, 2006 or something like that? It was basically this thing that was in the form of, the shape was like a flip phone that would record video and then send the video off to some other computer to be processed. So it was essentially doing image recognition or something on the fly with the phone. And it's sort of interesting to read the the sort of review of this from October 2007 in the New Scientist. There's a little article called "Video Search Makes Phone a Second Pair of Eyes," and let's see, you can sort of point it at, you know, stuff in the Asian grocery store that you can't read or whatever, and it'll tell you what's in it and if it's likely to contain peanuts and that sort of thing. But it's interesting to see what people, whatever this was, you know, 10, 12 years ago, were sort of seeing in this kind of thing. Because of course now it's easy to do that with your phone now. You can just point something in the Amazon app and it will tell you fairly accurately what it is and how to buy it. And there's a YouTube video linked there that has a sort of a demo of it, and it's actually interesting to read the comments in the YouTube video from all posted like 11 years ago.
Will we have this link in the show notes? Because yet again, this is something I'd love to take a look at.
It is, in fact, it is in the show notes, and it is in front of you in our own show notes as well.
Excellent.
Gasp.
All right. Okay. Another thing that was sort of interesting posted on the Facebook group, Tae Qian posted a print article about Puma's RS computer shoe from 1986. I think, and I'm not sure what this actually stood for.
Running system. No, you got it. Actually, yes, it's running system.
Pretty hilarious thing. It's a shoe that has a little block on the back of it that you could plug into your either Commodore 64 or Apple II to download the step count and other sort of things. And it's pretty hilarious actually to sort of see the original one. There's a 1986 video from the Comdex show. And in fact, Ken put this on his Apple IIbits site, blogged about it just recently, in fact, because of the re-release. So why don't you take it off from here?
Oh, sure. Thank you. Yeah, Puma re-released this shoe, although that is sort of a misnomer. It's a brand new shoe that has Bluetooth connectivity. You charge it with USB. It keeps track of your steps. They only released 86 pairs of them, which is a very limited edition. But I have to imagine that they're going to release it more broadly because they went through all the trouble to release an iOS and Android app that syncs with your shoe. And I can't imagine that they would invest those resources for such a limited audience. Cool thing about the app is that it has a Commodore 64-like menu-driven interface, so all 8-bit graphics, and it comes with a free game where it looks like you're some sort of a shoe flying around and shooting things. I can't play the game. I can download the app, but the first thing it does is searching for shoe, and if it doesn't find one of those 86 pairs, then you can't advance past that initial screen. My biggest disappointment about the new shoe, though, I really thought it was going to be a re-release of the original shoe, or that it would at least be backward compatible and would have a serial port. No such luck.
Yeah, these are very funny, though.
They're great.
The 86 ones are great.
Yes. And in fact, I wonder if those are on eBay, because that would be awesome.
Ah, perhaps there's time to check. Let's see. Another, going through the Facebook feedback that we had.
Easy for you to say.
The feedback.
That's good enough for me, I think. But Rocky posted an Apple II papercraft design that he created. It's on rockybergen.com, and you can take a look at that. And actually, if you're looking at that, we may have mentioned these a couple of times in the past for other things, because there are other papercraft things there. There's a IBM 5100, there's an Amstrad CPC 464, a C64, all kinds of things there. They're very nice, so take a look at those if you have not. Have you seen these?
I haven't.
Okay. Yes. I remember from, I think it was probably health class, when we were taught that if someone is in an emergency and you need someone to call 911, you don't just say, "Someone call 911." You have to point to somebody and say, "You call 911." And then it happens. And this is why I shouldn't ask, "Have you seen this thing?"
So you're saying I should dial 911?
No.
Very confused.
Good.
Where is this metaphor going?
Okay, so moving on, Carlos sent us email. Carlos is the creator of the Electronics is Fun company that makes the GuruNet Ethernet card for the Amiga that we mentioned on the last episode. And he, you know, said it's compatible with Amigas 600, 1200, 2000, 3000, and 4000. That the Amiga 500 hasn't been validated, and the Amiga 1000 requires an actual hardware modification. So that's why it's not available easily for the 500 and 1000. The Guru modem that is coming out soon, that is, it's a Wi-Fi RS-232 connector, something like the ones that we've seen before, but this actually seems pretty interesting. He said it's based on the ESPWROM 30 chip. This is not a chip that I am aware of, but that's because I am not aware of chips generally. The thing that I think is kind of neat about this is that it also has a microSD card, for storing downloaded files and providing local access to those files over the serial port. So that's an interesting addition to the Wi-Fi RS-232 cards that exist already. It has a TCP/IP stack, FTP, Telnet, and several serial transfer modes. And the plan is that it's not going to be a limited run, but it's intended to sort of be manufactured throughout the time that there's demand. So nevertheless, when it becomes available, and it isn't yet, but I think the first versions are in and being evaluated. But when it becomes available, still might not be a bad idea to get it when it is available, just in case. But it's intended to be continued. And the specifications and stuff will be open source, so in principle you can make your own, I guess. I'm looking forward to that.
So it connects to RS-232, but does it connect to the Puma RS computer?
Oh, that would be great.
Because that's what RS should stand for, but no.
Right. Running System 232. One last one. Andy wrote over email. Earl, do you know about this one, the C65 classroom computer?
Yeah, this is so exciting that as if the C65, which was a prototype computer at Commodore, never officially released, and it's kind of the unobtainium in the Commodore world for collectors, as if that wasn't exciting enough, now we find out that there was like a cost-reduced model for apparently the educational world. It's just, you know, you never can tell when you're done digging out Commodore prototypes that never got released. It just seems like for every one computer that Commodore released, there's got to be 20 that they didn't, that, you know, are hidden in a dungeon somewhere, and now we find out about one.
It's funny to hear about the idea of a cost-reduced C-65 in a way, because, of course, I think of a C-65 as incredibly expensive, but, of course, that's not the way they were intended.
Right. They were intended as, like, the last great gasp of the 8-bit world with a lot of functionality, but definitely not intended to be a high-cost machine.
Right.
But when there's only a few dozen around the world, then that kind of makes a difference.
Yeah.
Kind of like 80-some of that chew.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the collector instinct is strong. I can really see how the fact that they make only 86 of them will suddenly kick a lot of people into buying one that wouldn't have otherwise. Anyway, I think that'll do it for the feedback to date. I think there may have been some that I missed, but we'll get to them eventually, I hope.
All right, perfect. Well, then we can move on to the items of interest and news. And I guess I'm first on the bullet points here. Wanted to point this out. There is, on YouTube, you can find a series of videos from Curious Mark. And that channel, by the way, awesome. It's Mark Verdiel, and he and his colleagues restore all kinds of old systems, sometimes big iron, sometimes ancient teletypes, I mean, older than even the teletypes that you might remember, stuff from decades ago, and HP terminals, just a variety of items. And the videos are always very tech-heavy, very detailed, very well shot in terms of both the audio and the video. And so I love that channel. But anyway, there's this series of videos on restoring one of the Apollo guidance computers. And this year seems to be a lot of talking about the AGC. It's come up a few different times. But so apparently the owner of this AGC, a gentleman named Jimmy Locke, had collected it from NASA way back in the day. And he would like to have it restored in time for the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 in July of 2019. And so there, Mark and his colleagues, including a gentleman named Mike Stewart, who is an aerospace engineer and really knowledgeable. I read that he might be the most knowledgeable person on Earth from a technical perspective on the Apollo guidance computer. They are working to get the system up and running. And, you know, as things go, they've bumped into some snags. They've thrown amazing amounts of knowledge and test equipment and just, you know, engineering grit and know-how at getting this system up and running. And I won't spoil it anymore other than to say we'll have a link in the show notes to the playlist of videos all the way from the very beginning where they're first starting to examine it and talk about the contents to the very last video where they, to an extent, get some things running. And I think I'll just leave it at that. Anyway, it's just really a fun set of videos, and this will definitely cater to anyone who is a combination of a techie nerd and a space program nerd. And I definitely fit in that intersection. I was wild about the space program way back in the day, and actually watching one of these systems come back to life, it's just fascinating.
Yeah, that's really cool. I was thinking as you were talking about this that it feels like there's something sort of different about getting an Apollo guidance computer running and getting like a Timex Sinclair 1000 running or whatever, and that the AGC was kind of designed to be massively, you know, survive almost anything, right? You know, like it was super fault tolerant. And so you'd think it would actually be easy to get it going, right? Because I mean, like it should have been designed to survive anything except perhaps, you know, 50 years.
Well, that's part of the thing. And it's not just surviving that amount of time in terms of degradation of the components, but information surviving that amount of time and technical know-how. But they do address a lot of that in this video series. Mm-hmm. So with that, we could move over to Ken. Ken, you indicate that Charles Mangan has released Dropblock and blockchain. So is Apple II getting into cryptocurrency?
Yes. No, that is not what's happening. These are two new games from Charles Mangan, who historically has been known for Retro Connector, the various devices he creates that connect old computers with new peripherals and old peripherals with new computers. He's released quite a few games recently. This past summer at Kansas Fest, you may have seen Jumpy Man. And now he released Dropblock, which was similar to Columns, where you are dropping blocks and trying to match colored pieces together to make them disappear. And then he released Blockchain, which I, for some reason, thought when he released Dropblock, he was looking for a better name, and I thought he had renamed it. But Blockchain is actually its own game, and it's sort of a cross between Columns and, what do you call the mobile game? Is it 2048, 2048? You know the game I'm talking about. Yeah.
So I know what you mean, and I have no idea what it's called.
Right, because you
that's
never...
that's how you spell it.
Right. Is that how you spell it, with numbers?
Right.
Okay. So Blockchain is you drop colored pieces and multiple pieces of the same color shift into smaller pieces of a different color. I don't have the instructions right in front of me, but I think it's something like red becomes orange, orange becomes yellow, etc. So two reds become an orange, two oranges become a yellow. So you're trying to drop these pieces and make sure that the playing field has as few of them as possible by combining them whenever you can. So I have not actually played these games yet, which I regret to say. I did try. My emulator of choice, however, is Sweet 16, and I've had issues between that emulator and Charles's games in the past, specifically his Minecraft, not Minecraft, wow, Minesweeper. Big difference there. Although I would love to see Charles release Minecraft the Apple II. That would be a trick. I'm sure Steve Weirich would love it. But yeah, so I think that Sweet 16 not being updated as frequently as other Apple II GS emulators, and also the fact that these are 8-bit games, and I'm probably overkilling it by using a 16-bit emulator. I should probably just try something simpler. But they look pretty simple and fun. It's all keyboard-driven, so pretty easy to get into. No hardware requirements beyond Apple II or an emulator. And yeah, you should check it out at github.com/option8, the number 8, which there will be a link in the show notes for.
It's also cool that it's up there, not just open source, but open source on GitHub. Like, easily accessible if you want to examine how this was done, as well as have a fun game to play. That's a really neat thing.
Yeah, there's been a lot of movement in the Apple II community toward using GitHub. Quinn Dunkey has spoken about it at Kansas Fest several times, and I think she really inspired several people to do that, which I am glad to see. And also, the purchase of GitHub by Microsoft earlier this year does not seem to have deterred many people, which I'm grateful for.
Yes, indeed.
However, I will point out that somebody needs to teach Charles search engine optimization, because nobody is going to find Blockchain.
Yeah. Yes. My joke notwithstanding, that could be an impediment.
Well, you just drop the vowels, right? Isn't that the normal way you do this? BLCKCHN.
Fiction?
Oh, perhaps not. Well, okay. Yeah. Ken, you'll email him on that, right?
Oh, yeah. I'm right on top of that.
It is also on archive.org with the Apple II emulator as well. So you should be able to just, you know, click on the in-browser emulator and play it.
Brilliant.
It wasn't working that well for me in Safari, but...
Oh, boo. Is Firefox, like, the recommended browser for the Internet Archive's online emulator?
I'm not sure. That's the one I usually do use, though,
right,
for that.
And is there any Mac user out there with fewer than 3 web browsers installed?
Who has Opera installed? I still do.
I do. For me, I have Safari, Chrome, Firefox, and Opera, and maybe even, if I looked really hard, iCab.
Oh, yeah, iCab. I used to really like iCab.
Me too. Back in Classic Mac, that was my browser of choice.
I think they had some sort of ad blocker or something that built in, as I recall. Go iCab. And actually, I still have it. I believe I still have it on, like, my phone or something. You know, like, it does still exist in some way.
Oh, on iOS, I think I have Dolphin installed. Yeah, many to choose from. Moving on.
Well, that's the nice thing about standards, is that there's so many of them.
That's right.
So, Paul, it looks like you've got something about a tape speeder-upper. I just wanted to, first off, give you a grammatical congratulation on that.
Thank you. So, actually, this is it's largely about C64 games, so it's possible, Earl, that you have come across these before. So this is an article by Paul Hughes, who wrote something called Freeload, which other people have referred to as the Ocean Loader. It is a it's a loader for the Commodore 64 that was used by Ocean Software, I think, for a lot of games and things. Does this sound at all familiar to you, Ro?
I haven't encountered this before.
So the Commodore 64 is famous for having like very slow loading times.
Yeah, there's still a game that I'm loading, you know, that I started in the 80s. I'll get to play it someday.
Unless it resets at the end.
Right.
The article is basically just talking about the history of this quick loader, which, sort of the way it developed. And essentially he goes through various parts of this, but essentially it was a way to improve on the sort of built-in cassette loading. He talked about looking at the disassembly of the built-in Commodore loader and finding it to be completely ridiculous. So sort of finding ways to compress the data and also speed it up by using non-maskable interrupts, which allowed the possibility of, first of all, it could go faster. So as soon as there was some signal from the tape, it would interrupt and deal with it. But otherwise, he had designed things that would show, pictures and play music, and he even had some like Asteroids games and stuff that would happen while the thing was loading. And that was pretty cool. And also some discussion about how to protect the software, these games that Ocean released, from things like the freeze frame hardware interrupt thing, which is basically, it's like a cracking cartridge. You hit the button, it sends a non-maskable interrupt, and then you dump out the memory to something so that you can sort of restore it later from disk, and that could circumvent, copy protections and things. So one of the things that, one of the projects here was to try to circumvent that, to try to keep the freeze frame from working, and he talked about how this was partially solved by just leaving, at the end of the loading, leaving one interrupt undealt with, so the freeze frame interrupt wouldn't get to act because it was second in the queue, which is kind of cool. The whole story is actually kind of interesting. It's worth sort of looking at, but one thing that is kind of I found kind of interesting was some discussion of the actual protection on the tapes. So at a certain point, it became possible, relatively easily to copy tape to tape. And in particular, there were these dual cassette decks, which I'm sure we all remember, mm-hmm. 6D batteries or whatever it is to run the things. There was a sort of an interesting trick that this guy put in there to try to copy protect tapes, which was observing that they had, like when you copy, you do a like auto dub one deck to another, there's a automatic level correction that happens where it sort of scans to see like how where it should set the volume when it's making the copy. And so as part of the protection, what he would do would put in the tape these really loud screeches. So like the computer didn't pay any attention to them, but it would knock the gain down so that the dubbing procedure would like miss the next few signals on the tape.
Oh, he was using the auto gain control.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, fascinating.
I thought that was pretty cool. But anyway, it's actually a very interesting story. I'm not going to go through all of it. But if what I mentioned sounds interesting, or if you actually recognized this. Oh, and actually maybe one other thing that I'll mention at the end was that apparently he discovered much later that, when people started asking him questions about all these other companies that were using this fast loader, he discovered that in fact actually a bunch of other companies had sort of like pirated his anti-piracy thing to use in their own stuff, so because he never wrote it for any other company, but a lot of other companies seem to be using it. Anyway, take a look at that. It's I was pleased to see it, and I approve of his first name.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. And there's got to be some irony in it when your anti-piracy thing gets pirated.
Yeah.
It is kind of, I think, particularly fascinating in a couple of spheres with Apple and Commodore 64, how in both of those communities there was a lot of flexibility of dealing with the peripherals, and how the arms race ratcheted up between copy protection and the people who were seeking to copy the games. I mean, from a technical perspective, it can be some really interesting and geeky reading. And, you know, you can go far into the night with this. And the efforts that you see these days to be able to crack and then successfully archive some of these things so that they're not lost to oblivion is also interesting, because you get a peek into what they did to try to avoid copying and what we're doing to avoid the avoiding of copying. So, awesome. Well, I guess the next one is me, and this is kind of cool that somebody's built a, and this was highlighted by an email from Bob. Thank you, Bob, for this. Somebody built a functional 6502 microprocessor out of discrete 7400 series logic chips. And because the evolution of some of these TTL level chips has made them faster and smaller and better over the years, with this kind of 6502 broken out into individual discrete chips, the whole package can run at 20 megahertz. So not only is it a 6502 built out of discrete logic chips, but it can run 20 times as fast as the 6502s that we were familiar with from back in the day. To make this even more impressive, this can be swapped in for a real 6502. There are pictures of it and discussions about it being plugged in with a 40-pin connector to a VIC-20, and then software and games, BASIC, and a variety of programs running on the VIC-20, just happy as a clam, treating this external module as the real 6502. The person who did this is known online as DRASS, D-R-A-S-S, and if you want to read more about it, in addition to the c74project.com that we'll have in the show notes, there's also a comment thread over on the 6502.org forums that we'll have a link to, where the conversation goes on for 34 pages, which I think is close to 500 comments that are on there, over a time span of 2.5 years. And there's lots of information about the ongoing progress and some of the stumbling blocks that were encountered and then overcome. And this is just great. And I don't know if anyone other than the main project person here, DRASS, has created one of these, but I suppose you could if you want to. It'd be a big, chunky brick version of a 6502, but it runs and it really does stuff. So do either of you two have a look at this? This just seems like such an awesome little project.
Wait, I'm sorry, should I be dialing 911 now?
Yes, I think the time has come.
I think at this point that's appropriate, Ken. Thank you.
Yeah, I took a look. It sounds to me like it's nearly done, maybe not quite done, but the plan is to have... So as I understood it from reading the pages, the plan is not to ever sell this, but basically to make the plans available, so if you want to do one, you can.
Mm.
I think they're not quite... it still says this is a work in progress and stuff on the design page, but it's pretty wild. And I think we talked about maybe one or two times ago a different I think it was a different 6502 made of TTL chips, but it's, you know, there are a couple of ones that are of this sort, but I've never seen. Well, first of all, this one is interesting in that it goes 20 times faster and you can actually plug it in, which is just amazing. I mean, if you do plug it into a VIC-20, I assume it still runs at 1 megahertz.
Well, it must, because the computer itself wouldn't be able to run it any faster than that. And if it runs in a VIC-20, I don't see any reason why it wouldn't run in an Apple II, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think he was even, it looked like playing around with getting it to run in a Commodore 64, because he did an additional couple of tweaks that made it act like a 6510. a slightly modified version of the 6502 with some additional memory management. And I think that we have talked about TTL-level CPUs before. There's a KIT computer, and if I recall correctly, it was covered pretty extensively by the 8-bit guy on his YouTube channel called the Gigatron TTL Color Computer. Not a 6502, but a CPU that's made out of discrete TTL logic chips, and that's just so fantastic. One of the reasons that I love retro computing, period, just in general, is because you can wrap your mind around every single stinking detail of the computer, I mean, down to the individual components and how it works. And when you further break out the CPU into individual logic chips, you know, you're down at the ones and zeros. You're really seeing how this stuff works. And I've said it a million times, I think it's something that may be lost on the current generation of techies, except for those in the maker movement, because they're doing that same kind of stuff. But anyway, yep, a TTL 6502. How cool is that? What would you do with it at 20 megahertz? Would you build your own little computer around it?
Yeah, I don't know, actually.
Well, speaking of old computers, which I think is what we do, why don't you take us out on the news here, Paul? It looks like you've got the last bullet point.
Yeah, so I have one thing which, again, actually, Earl, you might know more about than I do, but there's fairly recently released this thing called FlashX 20, which was initially the idea was supposed to be it is a floppy and screen emulator for the Epson HX 20. So the idea is that what you do is essentially plug this into an actual Epson HX 20, and the HX 20 will send out, I think, both disk commands and screen commands to the PC so that it can, you know, you can actually sort of see in a bigger space. So the HX 20 is one of these little laptop-sized things that has a 4x20 character display on it, you know, so just tiny, tiny little display. But if you connect an external screen, then you have, you know, it's, I think, something more like a terminal, but, you know, you have a large screen, and it does have the capability of connecting with disks. And so I thought this was kind of interesting, partly because I thought of the HX20 as being kind of this little, I don't know, hermit or something, like something that doesn't actually communicate. It's not compatible with anything except itself, I thought. You know, it's not like the PX8, which is CPM. This is its own thing. But it does look like, you know, it has a full-fledged operating system and stuff on it. I don't know. So did you have a chance to see some of the discussion on the mailing list about this, Earl?
I took a look at the website that you linked over to. I didn't drill into it a whole bunch other than just waking up some brain cells from when I had played with virtual disk drives for the PX8. And the protocol is actually pretty similar. From what I understand, it's just a standard serial protocol, and it's pretty well documented. If you implement it properly, then yes, you can, using some sort of modern computer, you can appear to be a peripheral for an HX20 or a PX8. And I didn't know about the screen thing, though, that apparently this protocol didn't just have the disk drive access, but also had some screen capabilities that it could do some redirection from the, what is it, four lines by 20 characters or something like that on the HX20, but apparently inside the little operating system of the HX20, you could tell it, don't send the screen bits here, send them over there, over to an external display. I just think this is really cool. I have not yet dragged out my HX20 to try it, but luckily the HX20 that I received as a gift years and years ago came with some serial cables with the right connections to hook up to external devices. So I should just be able to drag out my HX20 and give this a try. I wish I'd have been able to do that before the show, but I didn't put that on my list of goals for 2019.
Yeah, it looks interesting. I would like to try it out. And so some of the discussion that was on the mailing list, whatever list this was, I'm not actually sure now what it was, but there it was noted that it was probably the same, it probably would work just as well with a PX8, that it's largely the same thing.
The redirection in CPM is going to be a little bit different. I think you have the con device, CON, that you can redirect where it goes. So, and that's just, that's not a PX thing, PX8 thing, sorry, that's just a general CPM thing. So I'm wondering if the protocol on the PX8 would support this level of screen redirection like it does on the HX20. I don't know.
Yeah. Would be interesting to try. The Model 100, Model 102s have a kind of a similar, I think, anyway, a similar video output thing where you basically just can redirect the screen to this larger area, which I think is still just kind of like a terminal. So like it's getting character serially.
Yeah, there's a thing that people have talked about on the Model T forums, a disk video interface, a DVI. And I've never seen one in action, but it sounds really cool. It sounds like almost like a modern-day docking station.
Yeah, I think it's actually got a little computer inside of it, too. I mean, I think it's actually its own sort of standalone little computer. It has disk drives, it boots. I have successfully once set it up, to take a picture,
Oh, you have one of those. Very cool.
I have two, in fact.
I don't know why that doesn't surprise me, Paul.
But, yeah, no, the funny thing is that when I first saw it, I knew it was like, this is super rare. I've got to get this, this unusual thing because it would be interesting to play with. And then as soon as I did, then another cheap one appeared. And I just, often I have this feeling like, well, maybe if I buy the cheap one after I buy the expensive one, then the average will, sort of even out a little. Anyway, yeah, I'm hoping to try this out. There's some hope of a Raspberry Pi version being constructed soon. Right now, I think it's just for the PC. But
well, that would be awesome. I did manage to, with a little bit of work, get that disk emulator that was out there for the PX8 to work on a Raspberry Pi. So I think it would be just a matter of porting it over. But it's interesting, some of the little idiosyncrasies you run into when porting something over to the Raspberry Pi. I compiled up the source code for that disk emulator. This is, again, years ago, but it didn't work when I first lit it up. And it was because on the ARM platform on the Raspberry Pi, as opposed to an Intel platform, they dealt a little bit differently with signed versus unsigned integers in C. So it's just this kind of odd idiosyncrasy, and I don't dive very often into the source code of these open source projects because sometimes they're not terribly approachable, but this one was really well documented. So as I'm digging in, I'm like, why is the menu just repeating itself and flying by? And I found that little glitch. So you can stub your toe when you're moving stuff from one platform to the other, but it's doable. I'd be really excited when they get that to run, because Raspberry Pis, they'll run off of some, battery-operated power sources and all kinds of things. All right, well, that is it for the news. So without further ado, a word from our sponsor.
For those parents who realize that $600 isn't too much to spend to expand their child's world, Radio Shack has the perfect gift. The TRS-80 computer, the most significant investment a parent can make. Programs for your child's education or your business, finance, and home use. Let your children discover tomorrow's technology today. The TRS-80, the biggest name in little computers. Only at Radio Shack. A Tandy company.
And we're back. And as is timely, based on this time of year, although this episode will probably be posted after it's too late, so ha-ha, but we do have the host's retro computing gift idea, and for this, I'm again going to turn it over to Paul, because this is an awesome idea, and it's his idea, and I'm not going to steal it.
It isn't even my idea. It came in from email feedback from James.
You stole it. Okay, yes, that's fine.
That's the honored tradition of,
good artist
Xerox
copy,
to Microsoft.
Great artist steal.
Yeah. So, the gift idea for this episode is a book called Robot Odyssey 1, Escape from Robotropolis by Fred DiGnasio. We have discussed, I think, at various times in the past this game called Robot Odyssey 1, which is a sort of like a kind of like a programming logic game was, you know, it's very interesting to play, very difficult to master, that sort of thing. But there was a sci-fi novel that is sort of based in the same world. And apparently it is, you know, it's got elements from the game in it, but it is its own thing, and it actually has some relatively good reviews on it. So even from people who didn't understand that it was based on a video game. So if you are interested in this, I didn't know it existed, and I think it is kind of cool. The link in the show notes will go to a search on, what did we decide? Abe Books, I guess.
I was going to say, how do you pronounce that again? Just kidding.
Yeah.
I do listen to episodes that I'm not on, by the way.
Okay.
Just to keep you honest.
Okay. So, but anyway, there's a search, and you can find copies of this for anywhere from like $4 to $108. You can find them for reasonable prices, and I think it'd be kind of interesting. The email that we got from James about it said that he picked up a copy online, and it turned out to be signed by the author, with a little note in the front to the recipient kid and the parents saying that she was good at the computer. So that was kind of neat, signed author's copy. Also, Fred DiGnasio wrote a lot of stuff, wrote a lot of articles for Compute and books and things, and was interviewed on Antic, the Atari 8-bit podcast, on Antic Interview 53. So if you want to listen to that, I don't think this book itself came up in that. I haven't really listened to that episode all the way through, but there's lots of other stuff to talk about. So if you're interested in that, go listen to Kevin Savitt's interview, Fred DiGnasio, on that. And otherwise, just pick up a copy of the book for yourself or for those to whom you give gifts.
Excellent. Well, and we have more opportunities to buy things because we have eBay and we love to party. So, Ken, why don't you start out? What would you recommend we have a look at on eBay?
I would recommend everybody go on eBay and take a look at these Puma RS Computer sneakers from 1986. I don't think I need to explain what these are, but there are several pairs that are from 2018, which we were talking about, and those are going for about $5,000. So you have to make sure that you're looking specifically for the ones from 1986, and I'm still not sure if I've actually found them because this listing is a little bit confusing. I think this is actually still the 2018 model that I linked to. Whoops. Yeah, these are going for $5,500. I was thrown at first because it said 1986 to 2018, and I'm like, well, which is it? So let me see if some of the ones from 1986 are actually on here. Yeah, these are all like the 86 pairs. Oh, that's why they released 86 of them, because they came out in 1986. I get it now. I'm so glad I stayed on this show long enough to put the two and two together. Yeah, so my bad. The shoes I linked to are from 2018, and I'm not seeing any from 1986. So this is not as retro as I thought it was, but if you have an extra $2,500 to $5,000 lying around and you want to wear that money on your feet, then you can buy these shoes off eBay. So, but let me stick to something that's actually retro, so to make up for that bomb right there. Snakebite, the game by Sirius Software, is a game that my dad used to play all the time. Now, my dad would fixate on a specific game, and he'd play it religiously. Now, like, he would play Tetris Attack. I think he played Tetris Attack for about 20 years, like, every day. Before that, it was Dr. Mario. Before that, it was Tetris. Before that, it was Centipede on the Atari 5200, I think.
The thing
Federal.
Is, well, I was just thinking, if you take 20 years for each game, though, that is going to limit your repertoire.
Yeah, I am right now listening to every game my father has ever played.
Yeah.
And before that, the game I remember him playing earliest, like my earliest memory, is Snakebite by Chuck Somerville. of which I think Brutal Deluxe recently released a slightly updated version. But I had a lot of games for the Apple II as a kid, my dad and I both, and in hindsight, I don't know where any of them came from, because they were all just on these floppies with handwritten labels, which I now know as an adult was not legitimate, but I was far too young to be going to school and trading floppies on the playground. So I don't know where these came from, but one of them was Snakebite, and it never even occurred to me until today that this was a thing that you could buy with a box and a manual, and that is what is currently on eBay. At the time of this recording, the auction has fewer than 3 hours left, and it does have bids, so it's likely going to be successful. It's currently going for $36, but this is Snakebite, published by Sirius Software, and it looks pretty official and in rather good shape. So that's kind of a good deal, in my opinion. $36 for a game that your dad loves to play? Do it. Get it this Christmas.
Yeah. How did Snakebite work? What kind of a game was it?
Oh, I'm sorry. Snakebite was replicated to many other consoles and mobile devices. Sometimes it's just called Snake, where it's just a single screen and you're moving in four directions, and every time you eat a plum or a rat or a piece of fruit, your snake gets longer, kind of like light cycles for Tron, and you're just trying to avoid your own tail.
Ah, I see. Yeah, I played variations on that.
Yeah, I think Snakebite may have been the original. I am not going to go delving through history to find out what the actual first canonical one was, but in my memory, it's the first one.
Yeah, Snakebite is so it's in the you know, I put air quotes, high resolution mode of the Apple II, and you know, so it's got you know, as good graphics as you can have, but it's still organized in a essentially 40 by I don't know what, 48 maybe screen grid. I mean, like, so everything, even though it is in the high resolution mode, everything's moving by like 7 pixels at a time or whatever. And one of the things that I do recall about this is that it was actually kind of ingenious the way it was programmed, because the game is actually, it's running on the text screen, which really is, you know, 80 by 24. And you know, so all the collision detection and stuff can be done by just checking what's going on the text screen, and then that's kind of mapped to the high-res screen. So if you ever hit reset, you know, while you're playing the game, you will see that the screen actually is, you know, it's there in the text mode as well. It's, anyway, just weird trivia that I recall about Snakebite, but I played this a lot as well.
And you're right that the materials do look like they're in really good shape. The box, the little fold-out manual, and the disc, none of it looks old and beaten up. It's like a nice artifact. All right, cool. Well, I'll jump in next, and I'll go real quick. There's a Pet up for sale on eBay, and it also looked like it was in good shape, not beaten up, and it has some of my favorite words on it, tested and working, and they actually have pictures to that effect that show you that is indeed the case. The thing that I like about this one, I've never had one of these, and I've only seen one a few times. They're not terribly rare. They're fairly common. This is the PET 4032, and they call it the Fat 40 because it had the wider monitor. If you see this picture of this Commodore PET, it is the typical metallic, boxy, sort of angular-looking computer, but as opposed to the monitor just taking up a portion of the top of the computer, it's wide enough to kind of take up the whole thing. And it's still 40 columns, but you get bigger text. It's just easier to see. So I actually like the Fat 40 series of the Commodore PETs. And if you were looking for one, this looks like a pretty good one. Now, the price they're asking, I don't know, might be a little bit on the high side at $599, but they do have the other button that I love to see, which is Make Offer. So if you're not inclined to pay $599, you can offer something of your choosing and see whether or not the seller is interested. It's located in Nova Scotia, Canada. Shipping to me would be $125. If you take a look at this auction, Ken or Paul, is that shipping the same to you guys? Is it just a flat rate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the same to here.
Okay.
To me, anyway. We'll see if it's to... I don't know if it's the same to Ken.
Well, gee, I hope so. Oh, that side of Boston? Forget it.
because Nova Scotia is a little bit closer to your neck of the woods, isn't it?
Yes.
I sorry. You know,
I mean, if you're not going the long way, then sure.
These things. So I have. It might be. I think it's CBM, not PET, and I think it might be 8032, but it's sort of the same shape as this. And one thing that I have discovered both from my own and, you know, looking at this too, is that it is really hard to photograph these and convey what you're looking at, because when you look at these photos in the auction, it just looks like, it kind of looks like you've got the keyboard and then a square thing that's on top. And when you're looking at it in person, it actually really is an angled monitor. I mean, like, you know, it's angled in that futuristic way that you expect a PET to be angled. But for some reason, whenever you render this in 2D on a photo, there's something about the perspective and the lines and stuff that just makes that angling disappear altogether. So it's very different to look at one of these in person and to look at a photo of it. I don't understand why that is.
Well, and the camera adds 10 pounds from what I understand. But, you know, it seems like they've tried to overcome that in this particular auction by taking some diagonal pictures of this. They've tried to capture it from several angles to give you a feel for it, but interesting. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but so it's tough to capture its true nature, huh?
Yeah, it's I've found it weird, you know, like as I look through my photos of the one I have, it's like, you know, because I have it on my desk because it looks nice. It's this sort of like futuristic thing, so I see it all the time, but my photos don't look like what I see. It's very, very weird.
Well, why don't I turn it over to you, Paul? You've got a couple things to cover here.
All right. So, the first thing I have, I thought was kind of interesting, is it's a vinyl record. It is, Alf's Apple Music 2, demo of the, I think it's the Alf synthesizer card for the Apple II. So it's basically just like, you know, some music that someone did with this hardware. It's a, you know, 33 and a third, double-sided. It looks to me like it must be a 7-inch, thing, although I'm not actually sure how big it is. It has a huge label if it's 12 inches, but I think it must be 7-inch.
So are you saying this was an add-on card for the Apple?
The Alf was, yeah, it's a music card.
Gotcha. And this LP is some music that was created with that card.
Yeah, so presumably all public domain music, but seems to have 7 songs on it, split across 2 sides. Interesting, anyway. I don't actually have a record player, but if I did, I would find this interesting. It's $100, buy it now, and it's probably one of very few that still exist in the world at the moment. So if you're interested in Apple II digital, you know, music synthesis, this might be of interest to you.
It also has a make offer. Just saying.
That is true. Okay, the next thing, this was something that Ian pointed out to us, actually. This is a 3M WhisperWriter 1000 communications terminal. And I don't know a thing about this, except it looks kind of cool. It is, so what it basically is, if you know the Silent Type printer, the Apple Silent Type printer, that was like a rebadging of something. I forget now what the original printer was. But this is that same printer. Is now badged as a 3M SilentWriter, and it has a little power button on it, kind of weird looking, like sticky outy key, and then it has a little detachable keyboard. I think this was essentially just something that would, you know, it's a terminal, you know, so it's a serial terminal, and I'm not exactly sure how the keyboard and the thing connect. But what's cool about this is, first of all, it's in very good shape. It has the manual and a couple of other things with it, and all the cables, so you could actually use it. It's been tested. You know, so, you know, you can see on the printing, the printout there, it says, this is a test to see if this thing is working. I guess it is. So that's nice. But yeah, so I think one of the things that I liked about this was partly just that it looks just like a Silent Type, you know, so it looks like a little Apple product. And the other thing that looks like an Apple product is that power key on the Silent Type is in fact the same key as the treasured power key on the original Apple IIs. They for the original run of Apple IIs had a power lamp in the lower left side of the keyboard that was that was basically under this key form factor. So it always looked like a key that you could hit, but it wasn't actually a key, it was just a light. And the keyboards that have that power key are the like the most valuable. They're the early ones. Later on, they just moved to a flat power light. But so I thought it was interesting to see this, you know, very same key, basically. It doesn't say power on it, but it's clearly the same thing. So anyway, it's interesting. I keep almost buying this and then not quite buying it.
It's probably a thermal printer?
Yes. Yeah, it is.
So what about getting paper for these? Is that still a thing?
I have no idea. I have a bunch of Silentype paper. I don't know if it degrades, but I don't know where you get more once the original stock runs out. Good question. Maybe someone can write in and tell us.
That's right. They can do our work for us. Let's crowdsource this podcast.
Yes, exactly. Everyone want to record something on audio and send it to us, so maybe we can just patch all those things together.
Many hands make light work.
Yep.
Except for the editor.
Well, right. Okay, the next thing I will mention is, I thought this was interesting. I'd never seen this before. It probably has existed forever. But this is three rolls of banner paper. So Memorex made paper. Usually you think of Memorex as making media, but they made banner paper, which is specifically for printing banners on your dot matrix printer, that where the individual sheets are not perforated. So it's this one long continuous sheet with tractor feet on the edge, I'm assuming, but without the individual page breaks in them. Have you seen this before?
That's a great idea. I've never seen this before, and boy, I could have used this back in the day.
Yeah. So your banner doesn't like tear in the middle as you're hanging it up.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, I thought it was a good idea. I'd never heard of this before, and you know, so there you go. In fact, I there are three, so you can actually make some banners with one of the blue ones and still have some, you know, pristine ones left. The color, I say blue ones as if everyone's looking at this, but there's two rolls of blue and one roll of white.
I would be kind of curious if it does have the tractor holes on the sides, because if you've ever tried to print anything, I mean, even a legal document through a dot matrix printer without having it feed through the tractors, you start to get a lot of skew over time. I could see the end of your banner would be, you know, at a 30-degree angle with the paper.
Right. Suboptimal, yeah. Okay, so the next one I have, I thought this, it's possible that I've just been buying too many things that are expensive, and so prices are starting to look smaller now to me, but this to me does not look like a very bad deal. What I'm looking at is a Commodore Plus 4 and an MPS 803 printer, both in their boxes. And the price that's being asked is $120 by it now, but the shipping is free. So I think ultimately, if you were at all interested in the weird machine that is the Commodore Plus 4, which, I mean, that's the caveat. You have to be interested in the weird machine that is the Commodore Plus 4. This looks like a pretty good one. It has all the stuff in it. It has the manuals. And the box is in pretty good shape. It has the box. And it also has this printer, Dot Matrix MPS 803 printer, which I think is a fairly common Commodore printer as well. Anyway, what do you think about that, Earl? Is it an okay pick?
Well, it's tough to know with eBay prices these days, or just, you know, retro prices across the board have been going up. I mean, there was a day not too long ago when a Commodore Plus 4 was almost a giveaway item. I sold one for $5 at one of our Commodore meetings, but not the case anymore. So the only thing that I would worry about with this particular auction, because you're right, everything in here does look like it's in pretty good shape, but they're saying they have no way to test it. And this, you know, that always sends up a red flag for me, because these things all have just regular old composite video out, and who doesn't have a TV or an LCD monitor or something like that? Well, I guess it would be a TV that has composite in. So when they say they have no way to test it, what does that mean exactly? Do they not have any power in their place, or do they, you know? So I wonder how hard it would be to plug it in and turn it on, because, you know, there are a couple of chips in these Plus 4s that are notorious for going out over time. So that is one thing that I'd be a little bit concerned about, but otherwise it does look like a decent auction.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think I've started becoming a little bit more a fan of the free shipping in a way that, like, before I could sort of, I sort of sympathized deeply with sellers that didn't want to just factor the shipping into the cost, because who knows where the person's going to be when they buy it. But at the same time, it turns out that eBay actually comes up fairly regularly with these kinds of, you know, various deals. Sometimes it'll be like a percentage off. Sometimes it'll be in the kind of like reward points that you get from getting things. It'll get like 10% eBay bucks for buying something. But those always those are always measured on the actual price, which means that, you know, if you're buying a $20 thing with $50 shipping, then you're only getting like the higher percentage on the $20. And so, like, I often, whenever those deals come around and I'm sort of, you know, looking around to see if there's anything I was going to almost buy anyway, I'm drawn toward the free shipping ones because I can sort of maximize the use of those things. Irrelevant point, I suppose. But part of what drew me to this was the fact that I know shipping would wind up being like, you know, $30 or something like that. So that's already taking a pretty big chunk out of what they're asking.
Right. And especially with the printer, because those things are kind of heavy.
Yeah.
It's also interesting. I thought the MPS 803 printer was a slightly different color, but now that I'm looking online, I'm seeing a couple of different color schemes. This particular color scheme that's shown in this photo would go really well with the Plus 4 because it you know, it matches the motif.
Great. That's cool. So the collector in me just dreads the idea that there are, you know, five different variants of every printer
with right.
the same model number. But yeah, I think I'll try to stay away from Commodore collecting. I'll see if I can succeed. Okay, and another one I wanted to mention is there's an auction of two Sinclair ZX80s and one ZX81 computer that's sort of all bundled together. It was basically just started at, I don't know what, started at a relatively low price. Well,
oh,
sort of, 65.
This one's going to skyrocket.
Yeah. They all look in great shape. I mean, normally, finding ZX80s in decent shape anyway is not that easy. Finding them at all is not that easy. ZX81s are even themselves not super easy to find here in the U.S. But so to have two ZX80s, one of them has had its keyboard replaced with a ZX81 keyboard, but the other one, it looks like it's in original shape. It has the manual, it has a bunch of wires and stuff, so it's neat to look at. I do think that right now it's got four bids, that it's at $71 as we record. There are 6 days left, and it's gonna be much more than that when it ends.
Well, and I'm wondering, the one in the middle, the ZX80 that has the what looks like an 81 keyboard, I recall an upgrade that you could do to a ZX80 to upgrade it to a ZX81. I wonder if that was done on the one in the middle. It's something that Randy and I talked about on Floppy Days when we were doing the episode on these.
That could be. The seller appears not to know much of anything. So kind of knows what to call the cables and things like that, but otherwise doesn't really have much knowledge about what the stuff is. So I think you'd have to get it and see. But they're small. You'd be able to fit them in the spaces left over from the other things that you're removing, right?
Absolutely.
I think lots of people would say that they fit very nicely under the door to keep it open.
That was kind of the canonical use for these. But not the ZX80, though. Those aren't,
right.
You don't want to use those babies for doorstops unless you like expensive doorstops.
Okay, and then I will close off my eBay picks here with a couple of sort of seasonal ones. I'm sure that this probably gets mentioned every year, but there's a program called the Jingle Disc, or Jingle Disc, I guess, which High Tech Expressions put out. And there are actually a couple of iterations of this. I think it's actually ThoughtWare and then later High Tech Expressions. But so I'll link to two of them. One of them is a 1985 version that is both for the Apple II and the Commodore 64 on a like double-sided disc, and the other one is for the Apple II and the IBM PC, and then it includes a card maker, a holiday card maker. And so what it essentially is like this little animation that plays the little Christmas songs and shows this scene of, you know, Christmas in a house with a cat and little, I don't know what they were, like a marching mouse and stuff like this. It's I've also got a link to a YouTube video that kind of shows what the animation is like. And, you know, computing has come a long way, but it's still sort of...
I remember these. These were so cool. I had this one with the cat by the fireplace.
So, and they're not expensive, and they're sort of interesting. So if you're looking for something seasonal for next year, I guess, then you can get these.
Very nice. Well, does that wrap up our eBay?
I think it does.
I guess we're into closing discussions then. Ken, you got any parting shots?
Well, this is the possibly last episode of RCR for calendar year 2018, and it's also the last week where I will ever have to say Kansas Fest 2019 isn't until next year. Because next week, Kansas Fest 2019 is going to be this year, which I'm super excited about.
Very cool.
I have no news about it. I don't know when registration is opening. I don't know who the keynote speaker is. I would not have any more privy to those details than anybody else. But I am very much looking forward to being at Rockhurst University July 16th to the 21st this year. Or July 15th, if you want to show up a day early, like everybody does now.
Yeah. I think they've added even like the super extra early option.
Right. The keynote is on Wednesday, but if people want to show up 48 hours early, why not?
Yep.
It's better than them making us just camp out in a line outside waiting to get inside.
Yeah, I probably will. I'll probably be at least 2 days early because I'm now on the committee.
Ooh, so you would be privy to details.
You would think I would, yes.
Hmm.
When there's something to know, it will be known that I know.
Wow, there are so many layers there.
That's so exciting, though. And Ken and Paul can give you the multi-year endorsement. I can sadly only give you the one-year endorsement, but the year that I was at Kansas Fest, it was absolutely the time of my life. So if you can go, you should go, and try to sign up in plenty of time so that they don't sell out.
It's true. They did sell out in 2017, not in 2018, because they raised the roof and the cap so more people could get in, and more people did.
Yep. Yep. I think that's true. There were more people in 2018, but there was the cap was higher. And I think, you know, the same kinds of issues will be in 2019. I know they're discussing some possibilities of alternate housing nearby, too, but...
Wait, what? This is news?
No, it was I think it was being discussed on the regular Kansas Fest list, but the like across the parking lot there are these sort of apartment style
Yes. I have been in those places. They're swell. Yeah, which are somewhat recently renovated too.
Right, exactly. And I think they might become available. I don't know where any of this is. I mean, like, I have no special knowledge about this via the committee. It's just like, you know, what I remember being discussed otherwise that they might be open to allowing some people to take spots in there, which would solve the shower problem. Because that is the, you know, everything is wonderful at Kansas Fest except the stupid showers.
It would create a very different tone for the people who are staying there, because it's basically four or five people to this two-story suite that has 2 to 3 bedrooms, a common area, a kitchen, and a bathroom. So it'd still be multiple people sharing one bathroom. But you would have to, when you put in your roommate request, usually you list 5 people and you say, I would like to stay with one of them. This time you'd have to stay with all of them.
Yeah.
Wow. I wonder if that would increase the amount of clickiness that would be happening at Kansas Fest.
I don't know. Like, I could, it seems to me like if I were staying there, I probably wouldn't be there very often.
That's true.
This, and for those of you know, people who are listening, I don't even know if this is going to stay in. But for those people who are listening who can't, who haven't been there, it's basically just across a parking lot from the main building that the main dorm that the events are in and that the rest of the rooms are in. So it's not, I mean, it's like a 48-second walk.
Right. This is the reason that the parking lot was unavailable to us this past year, because they were doing those renovations. However, those apartments are on the opposite side of Rockhurst from Etc., which is really the only place to go for breakfast.
Excellent. Yes, I still haven't. I don't think I've ever gone. Cause...
I get what you said. I got it. Excellent. Nice. Nicely done, Paul. Yeah, well done. Wait. Are you sorry? What were you saying? Have you never been there?
I don't think I have. I don't think I've ever gone to one of those. Because you know, morning.
So you've never been to Kansas Fest then?
No, I guess not. Not effectively. So, Earl, do you have anything to add for closing discussions?
Moving on.
For me, I've talked enough, so I'll keep this short. My VIC-20 is up and running again. Yay! I went to a Commodore meeting a week or two ago, and one of the folks there and I had arranged a little bit of an equipment swap because my VIC-20 died. It kind of died. It was limping along because the video was a bit garbled, so which made me really sad because the VIC-20 was the first computer I ever owned. And so anyway, got it back up and running and actually have some plans to play with it here during this week and a half that I'm off in between Christmas and New Year's. So very happy about that. But in terms of parting shots, Paul, why don't you close us out? Land this plane, my friend.
Oh, well, I'll leave the final approach for you, but and I don't have much to say except that what I said at the beginning, I think that the semester ended, and so I'm hoping to have a little bit of organization time snuck in here between the preparations for next semester, so that's good. And I also wanted to mention a link, since it didn't manage to get mentioned anywhere else. Blake Patterson posted a helping of 8-bit holiday cheer, which is sort of an annual post that he does with it's like a blog post that has a bunch of different vintage computers playing holiday themed creations on them. So take a look at that if you have a chance, and then you can also look at the previous ones as well. I guess pretty soon it'll be time to celebrate the holidays, and maybe at some point it'll even snow. I don't know.
Well, I don't know if it's going to snow here. That's not in the forecast. When it does, our town kind of closes down because we're not like Boston. We're not tough like that. When it snows here, things shut down, so we'll see. But anyway, that's it for this show, and probably that's it for 2018. A really big thank you to all of our listeners. We appreciate you listening to the show and writing in and being part of what we do on RCR. It's a real privilege to be a part of the podcast. I've enjoyed it tremendously this year. Looking forward to it next year. And thanks, Paul and Ken. It's always great to talk to you guys. You can find the show notes for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us or whatever you want to discuss retro-wise in the VC Fed forums. You'll find those at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. And if you don't want to try and transcribe all that, link in the show notes. You can follow RCR on Twitter. Our handle is @RCRPodcast. You can join our Facebook group, which has an amazing number of many hundreds of members. You can find that up on the Book of Face. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We're a member of the Throwback Network, which you can find at throwbackreviews.com. Again, a link for that up in the show notes. If you enjoy the podcast, please write a review for us on iTunes. It helps other people find us and lets us know how we're doing. And until next time,
Retro Compute! Call 911.
you call 911.